I'm Steve Zeitlin. I'm the director of City Lore. I'm 56 years old. I'm recording this in Grand Central Station on March 2nd, 2004. And I'm interviewing a friend who I've worked with for many years named Marjorie Elliott.
I'm Marjorie Elliott, 59. I'm recording this in Grand Central Station. Today is March 2nd, 2004. And I'm being interviewed by my dear friend, Steve Zeitlin.
Okay, so I think that one of the themes that we might explore in 40 minutes is your history with music, because I know it goes back to when you were a little girl, and I thought we'd talk a little bit about your home and where you were from and what role music played in your family from when you were a little girl.
Okay. Piano lessons. Well, everybody in the house played, and I can't remember a time when I did not. I've thought about that over the years, and it's really kind of simple to me. Learning to read music was like learning to read books, and you just had to do it in my house. I don't know why that was. That's it.
But it was an African American family.
Yes.
And where were you living?
Philadelphia.
Where in Philadelphia?
West 54th and Cedar at the West Philadelphia. And but everybody had a piano. We did that. You had to music was a part of being a whole person. It was as important as everything else. So it was really, really central to everything I did all through school.
So did your mom and dad play?
Yes. Everybody played and sang in the church choir, in the school chorus. It was all of those things. I played in the band. It was just music. And I listened to music. There were great records there. I often say that it probably has to do with the tribe we came from originally in Africa, the artisans. I don't know that, but there has to be some explanation why there was so much emphasis on the arts and what that did for you. I've concluded, as I've grown up, you know, this is something no one could take away from you. So there was a lot of focus on doing those things that you could do and learn to do well. The things that made you feel good about yourself, that had nothing to do with race relations and the state of the world and segregation and none of that. It all had to do with your being a complete and contributing person. Some of that was in there, but at the time I did not know.
Did you feel discrimination back in Philadelphia in those years?
Well, I never thought about it because there was so much love in the home and in the community. Everybody around me loved me. And there's the community, and there's the church, there's the black church, but I didn't look at it as the black church. It just was. So, you know, there was no talk in the house about, well, there's this group of people who don't like you, because they were very busy trying to turn out a healthy person. So I did not hear that at home, that I should not like white people or be afraid of them, because I was really very involved with white people, because my great-grandmother worked for a family and they loved us. You know, it was not a condescension. They really considered us a part of the family. And that was real. She worked for them, and that's how she took care of everything, and that's how she educated people. So I was very proud of that. I studied the clarinet, and my first teacher was white, but that wasn't the issue. He was brilliant. That was the reason for it. So they taught me that I was not better than anyone else, but no one else was better than me. So that we had no time for being afraid of anybody. Of course, you know what's going on, but there's just no time to go through that.
Do you remember some of the songs? Because I remember you talking about it wasn't just classical music you were playing, right?
No. All the standards, I remember getting, I would get gifts. If I did well with my piano lessons, I would get gifts. And I remember at 10 years old getting Body and Soul. Oh, I thought, wow, because there's the complex harmony there. I didn't know what the words really meant, but Body and Soul that the grown-ups were playing. So,
now, do you mean you got the sheet music?
Got the sheet music. And there I was figuring it out. And I just thought that I was so hip, you know. And Green Dolphin Street. I had all those sheets.
So how did Body and Soul go?
Da dee da dee 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 dee. Da dee da dee da dee 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 dee. Because we had the Billie Holiday arrangement at home. You don't really know what that is, but there's this haunting woman. And then I had the sheet. Oh. Wow. Yeah. So I got all of the sheet music. I remember clearly hearing Sarah Vaughan sing Polka Dots and Moonbeams. And I thought, wow. Then they gave me a sheet because, you know, instead of getting little stars, you know, for your piano lessons, I got sheet music. Yeah, it was really a whole psychological game that was played on me to really keep me together and hopefully turn out well. Because, you know, there's a lot of focus on that with all parents, that they want the children to turn out well. So the adults understood the larger world and what could await me. But they thought I would be all right.
So you're one person who, I think it's sort of fair to say that music kind of saved your life because it became so important to you.
Yeah.
Trying to deal with everything that you've been through in recent years. Do you want to talk about, you know, how music got you through the death of your son and your concerts and things like that? I mean, you should tell that story sort of as you see it.
Well, there's never a day when I don't play the piano, no matter what's going on. But the August day in 1992, when Philip passed away, was a Sunday. It was August 23rd. After the screaming and the crying, and the kids were crying, and all of this was going on, I remember going to the piano like at 2 o'clock and thinking, I'll play the tunes he heard me play his whole life. Then I'll play the tunes, the new things I'm working on. And I did that. And then I got the Oscar Peterson book, some really hard stuff that I was trying to figure out. And I played and cried, and at some point I wasn't crying. I was trying to figure out the music. And I knew that I would never be afraid to play in front of anybody ever again, no matter how accomplished they were. And that something else would resonate in what I did and the way I did it. And that's happened. I take a lot of chances playing solo pieces thinking that somebody wants to listen to that, but it means so much to me. I figure they buy the honesty of my intent. And it really has saved me, because it's something that's very accessible. It kind of tells the story of who I am, for whatever value that is. And it saves my life, the concerts, just doing it. And
so tell me how you moved from playing the piano on the day that Philip died to coming up with the idea of doing a concert in your home every Sunday.
Well, every subsequent Sunday after that, on Saturdays, I would get ready to have a breakdown on Sundays. Plain and simple. I knew I was going to cry and have my private little time. In 1993, approaching the anniversary of his passing, I called Morris Jamel Mansion that's next door to my house and said I wanted to do a concert. I didn't tell them why. I said I want to do a jazz concert in the yard. Great. They didn't have any money. I didn't ask for that. I wanted it to be a party. And I did it. And it blew my mind, just the notion of it. So when the concert was on the 22nd of August, Pastor John Garcia Gensel, so close to us, hosted. And I had these brilliant musicians there. I pulled it off. I got the money together to do it. So I was not crying. We were celebrating for Philip. So that was the first Jazz at the Mansion. And then all of that work went for the one day. Then I started thinking, I've got to do this. And I just did it. I started doing it every Sunday the following year in my living room. I took all the furniture out and created our own little studio. And I thought I could get people to come, because that first August, everybody said, "When are we going to see you again? We loved it. We want to do it." And I met so many new people. And we loved each other right away. I met these incredible people who did not know me, who found their way to the mansion. And I didn't want to lose them. And I thought, they want the music. And they did.
So I remember, you mentioned that you asked a neighbor if she thought anybody would come?
Rachel Kent. And I asked her, "Do you think this is a good idea, Rach?" She said, "It's a great idea." But I said, "Do you think anybody will come?" She said, "I'll be there." And to see Rachel walking up that hill with 12 people in tow, I called Freddie Orange at Hospital Audiences and said, "I must have an audience." And he had me call Antonio Rodriguez, who's in charge of homeless services for the city. And gosh, he sent 3 buses of veterans from shelters who love the music. And then I went up to the Armory at 168th Street, and I told the guys, "I'm doing this concert." But they said, "Can we wear this? Can we wear our jeans?" They were there. So they come every year. And it's unbelievable. It's, no one believes this, but you know it to be true.
So you really have a concert in your home every Sunday?
Sunday, rain, sleet, it's just great. This past Sunday, getting ready to start, you know, I always start on time, and this man came, "Are you Marjorie?" "Marjorie, hello. I am Ralph from Norway. I have a jazz club. May I take pictures?" And there he brought 3 people, and most of the people Sunday were from someplace else, not tourists. They said, we heard about you. You're famous in our country, and we had to get here. They consider it something very special. It really, I don't quite know what to do with that, so I don't have to do anything with that. It has nothing to do with me. I just get it together, invite the musicians, and leave it in the hands of the gods.
And so where do you live? Where actually is the concert?
555 Edgecombe Avenue, 3F.
And everybody's invited anytime,
yes.
Any Sunday?
Yes.
At what time?
4:00. Free.
And when do you take a vacation?
That's it. I have to be there to nurse the Sundays. I really do have to be there. They want to meet me. I haven't been playing Rudell Dreers, my son Rudell. I told him that he's really crossed into something so brilliant. I love listening. So this past Sunday was Cedric Chacroon's birthday. He's a regular there, saxophone. So Rudell, Cedric, and Don Moore on bass. Unbelievable. So I'm a great audience person. And I only play two or three numbers Sunday. So I love listening. And of course, I'm in the kitchen getting the refreshments together.
So let's see, how many concerts do you think there have been so far?
So we go from 1994. You know, I mean,
to 2004, that's 10 years.
Every Sunday.
That's more than 500 concerts.
Yeah. And in 2001, I started Saturdays because there are a lot of people who ask me if they can perform on Sunday. So I started Saturdays as a way to meet new people, listen to them, and it's really become a singer's workshop. It's glorious. We celebrate the American songbook. That's what we do. It's beautiful. And Rachel Kent is in that group.
So anybody can come on Saturdays,
yes,
too?
I've asked you to come and sing.
I don't know if you want to do that.
Okay.
So I know that you've had other kids that, you know, other of your children have been sick as well. So has the music continued to help get you through that?
Oh, yes. Well, it helps. I tell you this. Philip was so courageous. I don't know how he got to be that way. He was orderly, and he was so courageous in the struggle of being ill. And he made me promise to do all the things I do. My kids are really proud of me. And he made me promise to do those things. So I must. Michael has been very ill, and he's still in the hospital, but he's getting better. And they want me to do this. I can't not do it. It could go on if I were not there. I'd call someone. The doors would be open. And I have this core group of people who would take care of it. They know the drill. So it's going to happen.
So so what does jazz mean? Because it's a jazz concert. You know,
yeah.
you once told me that you think that jazz has a special place in African-American life.
Well, it does. We have to have something to hold on to. I mean, I grew up thinking that way. And I always say that we're celebrating African-American classical music because just growing up and listening and really having to listen to it, I mean, it was throughout any black community. You walked through, you could hear the music. You could hear it. And listening to the stories of the elders, hearing them talk about the depression and segregation and all the things they went through, but they always said, we had our music. So I grew up with album covers, with people on those covers who looked like me. And that was a source of great pride. People who could play like that, I had nothing to be ashamed of because they were great. So who's to say they're inferior? The word jazz was tacked on to the music. It's not a black term. It was tacked on. But it's very important that we remember this was called the devil's music. Race music. It was not respected. There are things going on now, but if you talk to the musicians who keep it going, it's not a pretty place. They're not looked out for. There are no places to play. But I'm very optimistic, because if we're going to believe, as we do, that this is our ancestry, that it belongs to the world, and I believe that. I believe it's folk music. That's inclusive. It's not going anywhere. I think of what goes on at our studio every Sunday. I have never heard anyone say, well, where are the black people? Or you have more white people here. I want anybody there who wants to experience this music. So I think, and I feel at times, a moral obligation to share my love for it with anybody who wants it. I work with children, and it's really the most important stuff I do. They're so beautiful. They are. They're multi-ethnic. It doesn't matter. That's never in the equation. So I have this hope that things are going to be all right. And they really love it. They love it. And I'll go on. And Rudell is playing so masterfully, and he really takes it seriously.
Are you very aware that, you know, because so many of your friends are jazz musicians, of how hard it is for them to survive and make a living? And
oh yes, you and I've had many conversations about that. And I think, and with your help, you're doing that for me, that somehow we'll turn the tide of that, because it's quite a shame. It takes a long time. It's a lifetime of learning to play on the level these musicians play on. And it's horrid that they have to work so hard to eke out a living. So in this, with this ray of optimism I have, will change that.
So tell me about the building where these concerts take place, because I know it's a very special, your building. Yeah. Tell us, what neighborhood is it in, and what kind of a, you know, it has a musical legacy that you should tell about.
Sugar Hill, it's called. We still call it that. I never call it that. I don't call it that. But
What was Sugar Hill? Where did it come from? It's the old name, right?
It's the old name, and what I've
for the
heard...
It's the old name for the neighborhood.
It's for the old neighborhood, because they considered themselves, you know, really very hip, very together. They're the ones making money. The history of the building, when they started renting to black people, they really wanted the rent paid. And people in show business had more money. So that's who they rented to. And others, Paul Robeson lived there. So it became the building on the hill, and it's taller. You know, I'm told the Circle Line used to point the building out. So it's 555. That's what they called it. And it's a swinging affair because Duke Ellington lived there. Count Basie lived there. Andy Kirk lived there 58 years. Lots of musicians lived there. Nat King Cole, when he came to town, stayed upstairs with Andy Kirk because of the racism of the hotels downtown, you know. So he stayed in our building. And Charles Buchanan, who owned the Savoy Ballroom, lived there. So that's, you know, that's what's kind of hanging over the head of this building, this history.
I remember when you said at your beautiful line that you had at your concert that you could sing the beauty of all this and still not blow your own horn, which I thought was a really nice.
It never occurs to me. I mean, I always tell the audiences, I get more than I give. They don't know what they're doing for me. And that's okay. But I know. I am so grateful to everyone who comes there. I cannot tell you. And evidently that's how it was supposed to be. I couldn't have known how I would get through having to bury a child. I couldn't have known that, but I had the strength to create this. So I look at myself as a catalyst for it, and I can address the issue of my own creative needs. But it's very, very exciting to create an environment for others, the musicians and the audiences. I get great joy out of that. That's really what I love doing. I love that.
Okay. That was all very, very beautifully said. Do you have any questions?
I do, actually. I'd be interested to know, because it sounds like this has come down to you for generations, and that you are passing this on to your own children. Aside from the music itself, what kinds of values or ideas do you think you have gotten from your family, from your parents, that you're trying to pass on?
I think the thing I learned, really the basic thing I learned was, you learn, you do well. I was raised by school teachers, so you just had to do well. So you kind of learned early that you were smart in school, that you could do those things. A lot was expected of you. You had to do things. My great-grandmother would say, come home early because you have to take food to Mrs. So-and-so. She shut in. So the notion of doing for others without expecting anything in return other than thank you was always there. I saw my aunts tutoring children so they could really learn. So the idea of working with children was always there. The music I passed on to my children, they just had to do that. I mean, they just had to do it. So theater and the music were all entwined. It's all integrated in my life, and I just don't ever remember a time when I wasn't acting and writing and playing this music. And the whole notion that you hear in black homes, every generation has to do better. Well, it wasn't any kind of mantle that you kind of wore around your neck to hurt you, but that's a goal that you do this, you do it well, you pass that on, you share it. So I can't think of not sharing with children. So the value is, I tell the kids I work with, the discipline that's required to play the music in any way that they play it, make mistakes, I don't care. But the discipline required in listening to it and to play it informs one's life, because it, look at me, okay, you know, and I don't feel that I'm set apart from anybody else. I'm very humbled by, I get so much attention, but I never think of it in those terms. Why?
Well, you know, here's another question I have to ask you. I mean, sometimes when, if somebody were to hear, you know, there's this woman named Marjorie Elliott, and she does a concert every year in her home in Sugar
Sunday.
Hill. Every Sunday. Rain or shine, in her home in Sugar Hill. You would think, well, maybe this person is like a wealthy heiress who has, you know, a gigantic mansion, and she opens her doors to everybody because she has, you know. And what's so remarkable is that you've had such a kind of generous vision of giving things away and giving this music away, when it's not as if you have any great resources to support you behind it. I mean, you're not, there's no philanthropy, you know, there's not, it's not like a philanthropic mission, you know, you're struggling to do it. And I think that's what makes you so remarkable. But how do you see it? I mean, you know what I mean? I mean, you might think that somebody who's doing this is like, you know, is a Rockefeller. They're opening their house. They're doing they do a concert every Sunday and on their lawn or so, you know, but this is you with a vision of what you want to do with your life. And it's not coming out of, you know, grand wealth where you just, you know.
Well, it's a lot of, I don't look at it as sacrificing. I know that if it's tied to celebrating Philip, it will be as I say it is, that no one is going to hit on anybody to pay to get in the door. It's really a celebration, a true celebration, in a concert setting with the highest musical standards. That's all of that. But I really simply celebrate Philip. It's never going to be anything other than that. And on the other side of it, I get a chance to work on my own music and write and do those things, because that excited him, and that's what I do. I'm getting ready to, and hopefully use it as a way to raise money, to do some writing, some new plays, because I've written a lot of plays, to use that to raise money, because I think the people will support it, because they know I don't lie in my pockets. But I don't think money is what could make this happen. I have to do this for myself, because this is what I know how to do. My theater background has helped a great deal in the dynamics of that, the way I set it up. You know, the kind of looseness that jazz musicians bring. Maybe I'll get there at 4:15. Nah. We start at 4 o'clock, whether everybody is there or not. And that's really good. I like that. And the audiences are the very best. They are great. They're great.
I have another question.
Yes.
In many ways, this is the creation of a legacy. Do you agree?
Mm-hmm.
Even if you don't think of it that way. But do you think of, if you had a legacy to leave, what that would be, how you would articulate that?
I, as a mother, I am always thinking what my children will remember of me. And I'm really busy with that and everything I do, because I've never felt selfish that I wanted to have my career and do those things. I've never felt selfish about that. So I want to get it to where they can comfortably carry it on in any way that they do. I don't want it lost. They know how important this is. It distresses me to think that the larger world cannot properly acknowledge the gifts and the contributions of Black people. There are a lot of inaccurate things said, and I'm talking about the music, but I feel, foolishly maybe, but I don't think so, the ancestry of it is so strong. The truth of the stories is in the music. And the good people on all sides, I look at it like the Underground Railroad, where there are good people of all colors, all backgrounds, together to do what was right. So that's my prayer, that it'll turn out that way, and that my children will know, well, Mommy did what she could do.
Did you sing for us?
Oh. No.
No?
What?
No. Something. A little something.
From Billie Holiday, or one of the songs you remember from being a little girl when you heard it?
Oh, wow.
Or
oh, I tell you, come Sunday, because that was in the Times article, remember? Uh-huh. And it does happen on Sundays. And the first part of it is just, oh, Lord, dear Lord above, God Almighty, God of love, look down and see my people through. That's from Come Sunday, Duke Ellington's Come Sunday. And the article that Dan Barry wrote because of you, Steve, he quoted from Come Sunday there. And I want to thank you. Oh my, I don't know how to ever thank you.
Anyway.
For the open house that you did November 1st and 2nd there. That was magic.
Well, we called it a rent party, right?
I know you called it that. I never would have had the nerve to say that. So I just said, that's Steve's doing. I didn't want anybody to think that I would do that, to mm-hmm. say that, but people loved it.
Because rent parties used to be common in like the Depression and things like that.
I know,
right?
But I didn't.
You remember them from when being a kid?
I never participated in that, because what I'd heard about rent parties, you know, they would gamble and play some music and they would drink a lot and a lot of food was there. So I wanted no connection with the term rent party, but you did, and that's what you did. But
somehow it caught people's imagination.
It did. They were not put off by it. Okay.
Is there anything else that you'd like to say?
I want to say something about Steve, because I haven't been able to write him to say thank you. Steve and City Lore, I want to say thank you.
Okay, well.
For what?
Well, that's
let her do it.
I want to say thank you because I'm never going to be able to write thank you notes to all the people who reached out to me, and that very dark time. And there you were. You were available to me. You always are. And I'll never, ever really be able to thank you enough. The only way I can thank you is to continue to do the programming and working with the children and make you proud of me, I hope.
Well, I think if you can, you know, as long as you continue doing a free concert every Sunday in your home, I think you've earned the thanks of just about everyone in New York City.
Thank you.